From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. LA's food scene is as diverse as the multitude of nationalities that make their home here. But there's no argument about it. We are a burger town.
The last time I went to Pine Burger, I walked in, and mind you, I've been going there for 20 years. I walk in, and some old guy who's been eating there for like a long time goes, "These f***ing hipsters. They'd never even heard of this place, and then now they love it here." And I like turned around, and I'm like, I would never hear that at Apple Pen.
Never.
That's Alvin Kailan, chef and owner of Egg Slut. He's also the host of The Burger Show, a web series from First We Feast. Season 2 just came out, and it's all about LA burgers. I had a blast being part of an episode with Alvin and Chef Roy Choi. I'm delighted to speak with Alvin Kailan and Burger Show director Justin Bolois today. Hi.
Hey, hi.
I still can't wrap my mind around the fact that you have jetted away.
Oh my gosh. This is the first trip back to LA where I feel like, man.
Did I make a mistake?
Yeah, I miss it so much.
So Justin, tell me, what were some of the major differences between directing the show in New York versus LA?
I think there are distinct differences between LA's burger culture and New York's burger culture. I think one is the size of the patty. So New York is thick pub burgers. There's a place called J.G. Melon in the Upper East Side, which is my favorite burger in New York, and it has a great sear and crust on it. It's thick, it's simple with American cheese and pickles. And New York also loves the potato roll, Martin's potato roll. There's like a cult fan base out there. That doesn't really exist in Los Angeles, where it's more of a culture of thin patties wrapped in wax paper, placed on the counter. There's, it, you know, you...
We have more of a gestalt.
Yeah. And, you know, in New York, you have to make a reservation for your burger. It comes out on a plate. It's a different vibe completely.
The car is not involved.
No car. I mean...
How can it be?
No car.
It's crazy. Like, having to, like, make reservations to get a burger in New York City, it's crazy.
Like, it goes against the idea of burgers.
Yeah, like, trying to just get, like, a real quick burger is, like...
Of course, they exist.
They exist, but then...
But like, they're not abundant like
no.
they are
no,
in
it's,
Los Angeles.
No, it's all about the slice.
Yeah.
That our burger is their slice.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I mean, you called...
Exactly.
And you called a burger in L.A. like... it's like a snack. It's like a power bar.
Yeah, it is. It's like, oh, I'm going to be stuck in traffic. I'm going to go ahead and get some In-N-Out really quickly, put it on my lap, and then as I'm waiting on the 405, I'll have a snack with me.
Yeah, you know? And you also get work done in the drive-thru, right? You're answering emails. Like, it's a productive burger in Los Angeles.
Yeah, 100%. In New York, it's like you're walking everywhere. You know, maybe you don't want to be in the subway at like 5 o'clock where it's like hot and packed. So you go to a bar, it's happy hour, there's a burger there.
So you're having a beer with it too.
Yeah. It's
there are trade-offs.
Yeah, it's a leisure thing.
It's a leisure thing. I love that.
It's not built into your everyday.
Yeah.
Like it is in LA.
I love, first of all, that you asked me to be on the show and to do, in particular, the Tommy's burger, which we all thought was pretty much a quintessential LA burger.
Oh, for sure.
But what role does In-N-Out play in the California burger landscape?
It's the nationwide definition of what California burger culture is. Like, it's like what is like the Hollywood sign to everyone else in the country,
yep.
except for us who are from here. You know, like when people say, I'm going to go to L.A., and then you're not from here, they like automatically think Hollywood sign. And like,
I actually had some friends visiting from upstate New York, and they actually went to Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah, like, who does that?
I was like, why did you do that? Yeah. It made me so sad.
I mean, it truly is a global icon. And I think in the context of, like, your episode, where when you think L.A., you think Hollywood sign, palm trees, and In-N-Out, and Tommy's was sort of a way to show a deep cut of LA's burger culture, you know, that this is sort of the secret handshake for people who live here and have, like, lived this culture.
Yeah, especially late night, right? Like, it's
oh,
like,
it's about nighttime. It's about yeah. that neon and...
It's the place to go. It's the meeting place. Like, growing up, going to the exact one on Beverly, it's like, I'll go out to, like, the Pig and Whistle for hip-hop night, and other friends will go out to another bar, but at 2 in the morning... we end up there and we just see each other and we're just like, hey, dude, how was it over there tonight? You know, it's like, it is. It's like a secret handshake.
Yeah. And then back to, In-N-Out is the GOAT. It inspired all of these chains to make secret off-menu items. I mean, that is so influential.
Is there a secret off-menu item at Tommy's?
No. Oh, I don't know.
No, I don't think so. It's just all about the chili.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they tailor make everything for you.
At Tommy's?
Yeah. If you wanted a hot dog in your hamburger, they would do it for you just as long as it's not busy. I've tried to do the gourmet stuff, especially because of Eggslut. We did eggs on top of it, avocado, bacon. But deep down inside, meat, cheese, bun.
Yeah, dude, that's the mantra of this show. The mantra of the burger show is meat, cheese, bun. Like, that's it.
Exactly. That's a good mantra.
Yeah.
Within that template, there's so much variation.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So talk to me a bit about the apple pan, which I know you did an episode on, another fixture of LA burger culture, and really good banana cream pie. Just have to give a shout out to the pie.
Yes, the pie is great.
Shout out the pie.
So describe the apple pan burger.
To me, it's like the classic. Thin patty, Tillamook cheddar, which is not American cheese, which is like,
good point.
It's key. And it's the style of service, too. It's an overall experience.
It's total throwback.
Yeah, it's different from In-N-Out, right? In-N-Out is like drive-through culture. There's no drive-through at Apple Pan. You sit on the counter, you wait until you are like able to sit down. You pick left or right side. And it's a funny thing because like if you're in the restaurant industry, you put your order in. The dude who takes your order like goes and reaches into this like refrigerator in the front, grabs like the patties, right?
Yeah.
Puts it on a plate and then gives it to the guy to cook it. Like, this is what I need. There's two burgers on my ticket. This is what I need. Cook it for me. So as a guy who like loves like the functionality of a restaurant, I'm enamored by the way they've made it work for so long. It's been there for...
It's the oldest hamburger counter in Los Angeles, if I'm not mistaken, 71 years.
71 years.
And it still looks so great. And, you know, even though they have those cone-shaped paper cups that disintegrate as you're drinking out of them, you wouldn't have them any other way, right?
Part of the show, I'm like, if you pour your soda before your burger comes here, forget it. You might as well chug it now. Like, you have to wait for your burger to get there before you pour your soda into the cup, because if not,
but
it's
I
not
think
fun.
The other, like the aura of Apple Pan, yes, it's about the burger, but it's about the guys who are working behind the counter, as we know. I mean, we interviewed Victor, who works the grill. He's been there for 43 years from Thailand. Put his son through college.
Yeah.
Working Apple Pan. You know, another guy, Hector, been there 42 and a half years. Right? That's a unicorn. That's an anomaly. Like, that doesn't happen.
I wish I could have employees that stay that long. Like,
yeah. And I know, Alvin, you were saying that's kind of like, for you as a restaurateur and like someone who does this, that it's something
that's
to admire.
So necessary.
For the first 10 years, he was just practicing.
Yeah. No, really. I mean, and
that's like deep mastery.
It pushes consistency because it's the same dude who's making it every single time.
Totally.
So the Apple Pan reminds me of another place in Pasadena called Pine Burger. Did you do Pine Burger?
So my brother is a big Pine Burger guy because he grew up there. He grew up in South Pass, San Marino, that area. I grew up in Pico Rivera, but by the time my parents moved to San Marino, I was going to college out here on the west side, and that's where I learned about Apple Pan. So then I'm an Apple Pan guy. My brother's a Pie and Burger guy, and it's a rivalry. we literally have arguments about which one is better.
So describe the Pie and Burger burger.
It's exactly the same. It's just they don't have the sauce. And I'm not saying flavor-wise.
Yeah.
Attitude-wise, also. Attitude-wise, also. The last time I went to Pie and Burger, I walked in. And mind you, I've been going there for 20 years. So I'm 35 now. My parents moved there when I was 17.
Yeah.
I walk in, and some old guy who's been eating there for like a long time goes, "These hipsters. They'd never even heard of this place, and then now they love it here." And I like turned around and I'm like, I would never hear that at Apple Pan.
Never.
It was crazy.
So let's talk for a minute about lettuce. Cupped or shredded?
Oh, well, if I wanted lettuce, shredded for sure. I love it.
I'm cupped.
Oh, I'm cupped. I can't stand
iceberg
shredded.
I love it. It has to be fresh. Like,
the texture's everything.
Running, like, I did a burger pop-up in New York, and we put shredded lettuce on a burger. And if I wasn't there, they would run like a day old, like, you know, just because, like, you know, it's like it's still good. It's just not crunchy.
It's disgusting.
Yeah. And so that was my only thing about shredded lettuce, is that it has to be fresh as hell. Because, like, if not, it's gross.
Well, it wilts. Yeah. Right?
Yeah. It's disgusting.
So did you grow up in your household, both of you, with home burgers? Did your moms or dads make home burgers?
Oh, my gosh. I have like a crazy Filipino. So we have lumpia, which is like an egg roll with ground beef inside. So because me and my cousins are very, like, I wasn't, but, like, most of us were, like, very picky eaters. My great-grandma would turn, like, the farce of the egg roll, and she would flatten them out and then put them in pandesal and make a cheeseburger out of them. So that was, like, our burger growing up.
Oh, my God.
Pandesal is a Filipino bread.
It's like a Portuguese roll.
Yeah.
But we like, throw a bunch of breadcrumbs on top of it. It's, like, very
fire.
Texture. Yeah,
very, it's very fire. Texture.
And what was yours like, Justin?
I had the classic backyard burger, sort of, like, thick patty, and probably, like, using techniques that I would question now, whether it's, like, putting egg yolk in it or...
The thumbprint.
It's sort of adapted now because our home burger is the Oklahoma onion burger, which is basically like a smash burger with thin sliced Vidalia onions. You smash that sucker and the outside of the onion's crisp, and then it like renders and gets real soft in the middle with like a very small roll. So I've shifted, and I'm very happy about that decision, dude.
So yeah, now my burger at home is like King's Hawaiian buns, because they have them now, and ground beef and cheese. And then I'll just have condiments. It's like you can't make a standard burger at home. Everyone wants it their own way.
Okay, so ideal order of ingredients within the bun.
We talk about this a lot.
Hot bun issue.
I'm more of the squishy stuff on top and the crunchy stuff on the bottom. Like cheese, tomato, let that marry on the top. And then nice bite of beef, crunchiness of either onion or lettuce on the bottom.
Ooh, that's interesting.
Yeah. I've like really like tried it different ways, but the way everything interacts with the beef, I think that to me made the most sense.
Yeah.
This is like one of the best conversations I've had in a while. Well, thank you so much. So The Burger Show, where can we watch it?
YouTube.com/firstwefeast.
There we go. I've been talking with Alvin Kailon and Justin Bolois. Season 2 of their series, The Burger Show, is out now. Watch it on YouTube or firstwefeast.com. Amazing produce is at its peak this time of year, so we're paying a visit to a legendary market in Berkeley. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. If you've ever shopped for produce in Northern California's East Bay, there's a pretty good chance that you made a stop at the Berkeley Bowl. The market's been a Berkeley cornerstone since its opening in 1977. It's known for its extraordinary produce, unusual fruits and vegetables, things even I haven't heard of. It's a place of culinary education and a refuge for curious eaters.
The produce at Berkeley Bowl is always so fresh, and you can tell that it's really been selected based on its taste that day.
That's Oakland native and author Laura McLively. She's the author of the Berkeley Bowl Cookbook, which takes you through the aisles of this fascinating place.
A lot of people think that Berkeley Bowl, which is an amazing grocery store located in Berkeley, is called that because it's alluding to some sort of salad bowl. But it's actually called that because the owners, Glenn and Diane Yasuda, opened up the original store back in 1977 in a converted bowling alley. And so they actually kept the name the same. They started that little location there, and it was mainly produce, and it grew and grew until it's now these two amazing locations with more produce and more varieties than you could ever possibly imagine. And that's what's made it a very special place in the Bay Area, because allowing us to have so much access to not just so many varieties of normal produce, quote-unquote normal, like apples and lettuce, but so many things that most people have never seen or heard of before. And so in that way, it's allowed us to be exposed to these things and has really shaped the culinary movement here in the Bay Area.
Is the same family still running it?
It is. It's still family run. Glenn and Diane are now in their 80s, and they run it along with their son, Gen. They're both still very involved. And in fact, Glenn is still the produce buyer. So he still wakes up at 2:30 every morning and gets in his car and drives across the Bay Bridge to go to three different produce wholesalers all by dawn. And he still does that himself in his older age.
And how important is it that he still hand buys like that?
It's incredibly important. When I spoke with him in preparing the intro to this book, he really emphasized that the value of the relationship, like the face-to-face contact and the relationship that he's built with these produce sellers and these farmers that he works directly with. And so, you know, just in speaking with him, it became obvious that he feels like he still has to do that himself because he's invested all this time and throughout all these years in creating this relationship that allows him to show up at a warehouse and someone set aside the last bit of sour plums for him.
He also is known for buying for that day. He's not like other supermarket produce buyers who are buying for the week or maybe even a longer time frame than that. So the consumers are getting something quite extraordinary.
Yeah, I think one of the things that people talk about when they buy produce from this store is that it's fresher than most grocery stores. And that's because he is tasting the food that very morning and selecting it based on its quality. And that's the same produce that shows up in his store later that day. That's a huge contrast to what you get at a typical conventional grocery store, where produce has to be purchased from large centralized warehouses and then shipped off in trucks and distributed to all the individual locations. And so produce is maybe tasted and purchased days before it ends up on the grocery store shelves. And as a consumer, we notice that when we go to pick up something that looks ripe, but in fact, it doesn't really taste ripe. And also maybe it perishes really easily in your fridge or on your counter.
Did you grow up shopping there?
I didn't. I'm from Sonoma County, which is about an hour north of Berkeley. And I moved here in 2002 to attend college at UC Berkeley. And that was the first time I had heard of that grocery store. And I immediately went down there. I actually took the bus since I didn't have a car at the time. And I hadn't yet learned the lesson that most people who shop there know, which is you will never just go to buy an apple. Like, you always end up buying more than you think you wanted. And so I ended up buying that first trip. I saw a sign for yellow watermelon. And I thought, oh my gosh, I have to try this. So I put a yellow watermelon in my grocery cart. And then I saw all these beautiful tomatoes because it was September. And so I decided I'd make gazpacho because I knew we had a blender back at my dorm. And so I bought all, you know, 10 pounds of tomatoes and cucumbers and peppers, and then realized my mistake that how am I going to get this watermelon and all this produce home? So I had a pretty difficult walk to the bus stop, and then from the bus stop to my apartment or to the dorm. Then from then on, I actually learned my lesson, and I went to the grocery store with this huge rolling suitcase that you would take on an international trip. And so I would pack that up at the register and drag that onto the bus.
Such a great image. Was there an item or a time that you shopped there that made you realize that you needed to expand your produce horizons?
Yes, there was a definitive time, and it actually came years later. So like I said, I started shopping there in 2002, and I always had admired not just the quality and variety of produce, but some of these more niche items that I had never seen before. So like cactus paddles and banana flowers and amazing mushrooms that of all different colors, and the tropical fruits like rambutan. And so I'd always pass these in the market and I'd pick them up and I'd admire them. But then I just felt like there was something in me that made me feel like I didn't have permission to take them home. Like, oh, well, I didn't grow up eating these. These aren't part of my culture or my upbringing. And so I just let them be and I'd move on. And it wasn't until in 2013, I moved to Spain with my husband and lived at the house where my mom grew up there. And I was working at a municipal market there. And it's set up the way that we always admire these European markets, where there's a stall for cheese and a stall for meat and produce. And I loved watching all these unique ingredients coming in and out of the market. And so I made a friend there, and he got a kick out of how excited I was, like, what is that clam? And what do you do with that part of the animal? And he suggested, why don't we, once a week, we'll just choose something you've never cooked with before, and we'll go back to my house and we'll cook it together. And so we did that for a year every week. And I had so much fun kind of pushing myself outside of my comfort zone and exploring new ingredients that when I got home and I found myself back at Berkeley Bowl for the umpteenth time, I was just there with a new perspective. And so I passed this African horned melon, which is on the back of the book. It's this beautiful, bright neon orange orb covered in spikes, and it oozes lime green juice. And I just saw that, and something was changed in me. And I thought, I'm going to take that home today. So I took it home. I cut it open. I had so much fun playing around with it and developing a recipe for it that I decided, you know, I'm going to do this with every single unknown ingredient to me in the store. And so that was the start of this journey.
What did you end up making with that African horned melon?
After tasting the juice, it's a unique flavor. It's like a bright, limey melon scent mixed with banana. And I thought, well, this would be really good in a cocktail. So I muddled it to remove the juice from the seeds and made it into a Kiwano cooler, which is a cocktail in the book.
That sounds really good. Give us a few more of your favorites from items that we, like you, may have been too afraid to play with.
There's so many. So it's easier for me to think about it in terms of which type of plant we're talking about. So I've actually organized the book into chapters based on what the plant is, what this edible plant is. So for instance, there's a chapter on stems and one on flowers, seeds, and pods, and leaves and succulents. And that's because that's sort of how one shops there. You just show up and wait to see what you find, and that ingredient drives the development of the recipe and also what you choose to make. Let's see, like if I just think of spores and succulents, I think one of my favorite recipes is sea beans are also called salicornia. They're these really small, spindly succulents that grow in saltwater bogs, and they are actually, you can forage them here on our coastline. But no, it's so shocking to me that most people have never seen these or tasted them because they're amazing. When you bite into it, it's this salty, crunchy burst into your mouth. And so I'm addicted to them, and you can just toss them raw into anything, or you can saute them or blanch them. But the way I like to have them is in this recipe for soba noodle salad. It's because it's a really nice contrast, that salty crunch against the silky soba noodles, and it's mixed with Thai basil and sesame oil and some Fresno chili. So it's a really nice, refreshing lunch or brunch food.
You have a recipe in the book for a Buddha's hand scone, and In the recipe, you talk about using the pulp. And I'm embarrassed to say that all these years, it's never even occurred to me to try to use the pulp.
Yeah, so that's the beauty of Buddha's hand, is that it's a type of citron, and so the pith and the pulp are actually edible. They don't have that bitterness characteristic of other citrus like grapefruit and oranges. And so, in fact, when you slice open a Buddha's hand, there's very little fruit inside. There's like maybe a walnut-sized core that has a little bit of fruit, but it's not really edible. It's really the pith and the rind of the Buddha's hand that's what you eat. But you could also slice off a finger and steep it in some boiling water to make a really fragrant tea. Or you could just chop up each finger and make marmalade or candy it. But the way I love to do it is to chop it up and fold it into a scone batter, because it really infuses that lemony, citrusy scent into the whole scone.
Wow, that just sounds so good. I'm definitely doing that.
Yeah, and it's so simple. I think that's one of the things that I wanted to show people, is that these ingredients look intimidating. Like when you pass a Buddha's hand in a farmer's market or the store, it's like, what is this tentacly bright yellow fruit? It just looks unapproachable. Or people look at these and they're like, I just would never have any idea what to do with that. And so they're not taking advantage of the access we have here in California. What I hope to do with this book is to show people that they're actually as normal to someone as tomatoes are to me or to you. So that's for a good reason, and you have to find out why. And so if you take it home and maybe you follow one of these recipes, you'll see, oh, it's pretty simple. You just chop it up and fold it into a scone. And maybe from there, you'll start incorporating it into your own favorite recipes and your own family recipes.
That's Oakland native and author Laura McLively. She's the author of the Berkeley Bowl Cookbook. Of course, you know that we have some pretty fabulous markets in LA too, especially our local treasure, the Santa Monica Farmers Market. We're heading there now with Laura Avery as our guide.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're really launching into July here in a big way at the Farmers Market, and I'm really happy to be talking with Steve Roberts, who is chef owner of Hop Saint down in Torrance. And Steve is here. He's got a cart piled. We were lucky to catch up with him because he walks so fast. And Steve, today, tell us what you're shopping for and what's going to be on the menu in mid-July.
In mid-July, we're taking advantage of everything this great market has to offer as far as summer's full swing right now. So the cart that I just pulled past when you stopped me, I had it loaded up with corn, and we do a couple things with it. We do a succotash as a side for some of the barbecue we do at the restaurant, and succotash consists of, you know, depending on what beans we can get, I like to use the fresh in season. So right now we'll do a green bean succotash, has some poblanos in it, shallot, a little cream, a little thyme, and roast the corn first. And then the other thing we do with the corn is we roast it in the pizza oven. It's a hearth, 800 degrees, and then we top it with a jalapeno butter and some cotija cheese, a little cilantro.
Where'd the succotash recipe come from?
Well, it's grandma and mom, but out here, you know, in Louisiana at that time, you know, it was back in the 60s and 70s, and there weren't a lot of chilies around where we grew up, so it was a real basic recipe. In California, there's a lot of things you get to introduce to it. The fresh chilies, especially right now, they're just starting to come into the market. And also the tomatoes, cherry tomatoes go good in a succotash. We'll use those as the season comes along. You know, it's a real versatile dish. It's an old Indian dish, actually. And so it's just been done so many different ways. And I think a lot of chefs have fun with it.
So the best way to roast corn, if you're not doing it on a grill or if you're doing it in your oven, do you leave any of the leaves on? Do you soak it?
Well, you know, there's two ways to do it. Yes, you can. We take advantage of the open fire, and we want that char on the outside. So if you wrap it and it's moist, you won't get that char. It'll be more almost like steaming it, if mm-hmm. you will. But you know, they both taste great. We just choose to do the char thing.
And when you do your 800 degree pizza oven, but that's not on an open flame, isn't that on a tray or on a...
It's a hearth. It's a domed, it's stone lined, and we burn only wood at the restaurant, and we burn it three ways. Sometimes we throw the corn on the open grill, sometimes in the hearth, and then we have a smoker out the back that we do all the meats on that succotash and that street corn goes really well with. You know, we do brisket, pulled pork.
When you're roasting the corn, are you turning it every so often to get that char on the bottom? So someone's got to watch it and use tongs? Okay.
And it doesn't take long in an 800-degree oven.
So. I was going to say, like a minute per each relay.
Yeah.
Okay, so Hop Saint down in Torrance, you do, you have a brewery down there too, right?
Yeah. Brewery.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we've been there 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to actually get 150 pounds of white peaches from Troy Redgear.
Uh-huh.
So we can do peach beer over the summer here.
Like a Saison?
Yes, ma'am.
Summer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Summer.
Okay. And then you're a chef. You've been around a long time. You were down in Redondo Beach. You had Cafe Boogaloo.
Yes,
you've been in the South Bay forever. Now, this is your new enterprise, and so you're what we would call the executive chef?
You could call that. I think that word gets thrown around a little loosely. I just been around food my whole life, and I kind of tuned into the market. And we just do the best we can to cook fresh food for people that don't normally get it.
Mm-hmm. You know? And you're from the South.
I am from Louisiana, actually.
Okay.
So.
New Orleans?
I'm actually from Baton Rouge. I was born in Baton Rouge and grew up in a little town called Bunky.
Bunky?
Yeah, look that one up.
I will. How do you spell it? B-U-N?
B-U-N-K-I-E.
Bunky, yes, Louisiana.
That's it.
All right, that's got it.
So that's where I kind of gone full circle with the whole market fresh thing. You know, we grew up in a farm community, and it's the closest I can get to something like that is at the markets in Southern California, and Santa Monica being the one I've been going to the longest. So.
You have, and then you've gotten to know all these farmers.
All of them.
So well.
And their kids.
And the kids, right. All right, Steve, well, thank you. That sounds so great, and so many great ways to enjoy what we have here at the market. Thanks for all the tips.
Again, thanks for having me.
That was Steve Roberts, and he is executive chef, although he likes to think of himself as more of the behind-the-scenes kind of guy, at the market shopping here for many, many years at Hop Saint down in Torrance. I'm talking now with Gloria Tamai, who is the owner of Gloria's Produce up in Oxnard. She and her parents used to come to the market. She's here with her kids. We got three generations now coming from the Tamais. And Gloria, for years you have grown corn. You used to grow the white. Now I notice this year you've got the yellow corn. So tell us about how you grow the corn and where you're growing it.
Okay, right now the corn we're growing in Camarillo. We used to grow it in Fillmore, but now we're in Camarillo because it gets super hot in Fillmore and it's too hot. So we decided to grow the yellow corn because a lot of the restaurants asking for yellow corn and a lot of the customers, I don't know what happened. They say have more vitamins or something. I don't know. It's better for you. That's what I hear.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Ohio. When I got to California, all I saw was white corn, which I had never seen in Ohio. So it's almost like white corn was kind of a California thing or kind of a new thing. And corn in California, now the prices, yours are 75 cents an ear.
Yeah, and you know it's because everything been more expensive. Growing stuff, seed, water, everything is coming more expensive for us. So yeah. We had to raise the price.
Yeah.
When I used to sell it $3, $4, I remember years ago, when everything used to be cheaper. This year we were thinking and go higher, but I said, no, we can't.
Yeah.
We don't want to hurt our customers. You know, we were trying to give it the best price we can.
And you grow right now, you said in Camarillo, how often are you planting and how long will you have the corn?
Okay, we're hoping to have it all the way to October, November, like we usually do.
Yeah.
So we planted a patch like every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
That way we have it corn every week.
And how many ears of corn do you get off one big stalk?
Sometimes we get lucky, we get two.
Sometimes only two?
Only two for 3 months of growing corn.
Yeah. Really?
For all that work. That's why it's expensive.
Yeah. And do you plant little corn kernels in the ground?
Yeah. Corn by corn.
Oh, okay.
Good thing it's a machine.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Can you imagine by hand?
No, I can't imagine. So when you go in there to harvest, you're walking between the rows and they're just
pulling out. Yeah.
Right.
Sometimes we cut it with the knife, but it's too dangerous with the knife for the workers. So we sometimes just trying to pull it.
So hot. And then during the day, it must get very hot in there.
We try to do it early in the morning, the early we can in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And we just pick what we can sell and that's it.
Right. Well, it's beautiful corn. I mean, it looks delicious.
It's real good. It's real delicious. You know my corn.
I love your corn.
My customer know my corn. Yes. I hope so they enjoy this corn.
That was Gloria Tamai. She and her family have been coming to the market for three generations, and they can be found Wednesday, Santa Monica, Pico Farmers Market, Santa Monica, and Saturday downtown.
Yeah. That's right.
For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
In a minute, we're talking to someone who wants to throw out the old rule book when it comes to wine. That's when Good Food continues. It's Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Few things are as intimidating as a wine list. Your mind scrambles to recall pairings, prized vintages, or what time of year is socially acceptable to drink rosé. Wine seems almost like this strange ancient religion with its orthodoxies and doctrines. John Bonnet says it doesn't have to be that way.
In some ways, the book came out of feeling like it was time to move past this very bro-y era of wine is fetish, wine is baseball, wine is a thing for people with no better things to do on a Saturday night to geek over and make everyone feel insecure about.
John Bonnet is perhaps one of the foremost writers on wine in the world today. In his new book, The New Wine Rules, he argues that wine should be approachable and fun, especially when we do away with the legalisms. So people have been drinking wine literally for eons. Why is it that we're still decoding it?
Well, I think for a long time, people just didn't worry a whole lot about it. And then there was a period of time when wine became a social marker. My somewhat trite analogy, but a useful one, is that wine is fashion. And whether, you know, fashion, baseball, whatever, it's this thing that became fetishized because especially as Americans were becoming more upwardly mobile, they were switching away from hard cocktails. This is all sort of mid-20th century. Wine became a status marker, and over time, especially in, let's say, starting in the 1990s, it became a very high-dollar status marker and a way to differentiate yourself. which I think was just growing pains in a way, but it did give at least a generation's worth of wine drinkers a sense that there was a lot of fear surrounding wine.
So you want to bring back the joy?
I do want to bring back the joy. And I think I want to, but I actually think if you look at the way that the emerging generation of wine drinker is drinking, they're already there. They're not worried that much about having to know everything and having to memorize all the places and grapes. They're just diving in. And I think some of that is that they came up in households that did have wine on the table, and their parents did become very insecure and kind of catty about it. And they, as all younger people do, wanted to do exactly the opposite of what their parents did. So I think that you see people, certainly younger than me, are just kind of diving into the world of wine and having fun.
To me, when I think about the most important thing for a person who drinks wine, not, you know, who wants to buy a bottle and drink it at home, which to me is like the best way in, so that when you go to the restaurant, you like kind of have a base, is to find a good wine shop.
Absolutely.
How important is that?
It is extraordinarily important. It is maybe, I'm trying to think if there's anything else, it is maybe the most important thing you can do because, you know, whatever you like, you need to find, I was going to say a good dealer, but a good purveyor, you know, and as much as anything, someone who's really good at what they do is going to be a guide.
And so if we're standing in the wine shop, how do we know it's good? Could you tell us about the champagne test?
Yeah, so the champagne test is if you're in a wine shop, and champagne is traditionally has been the most heavily marketed of all wines. It's the one that actually has something closest to brands, and has, like I said, for a long time, and it's really guided by its large, its grand marc, its big houses. And so the rule of thumb today is if you walk into the shop and you recognize more than half of the labels, assuming you're not me and you don't spend too much time studying up on these things, if you recognize more than half the labels, walk out, because it's a shop that just isn't that committed to discovery. They're taking the easy road, and you don't want a shop that's taking the easy road, because the whole point of going to a good wine shop is that they're doing all the work for you.
So basically it's like going to an indie bookstore.
Totally.
I love that. And how bad do we have to feel about being stupid?
I have met some stupid people in wine, but it's, I think, a different definition. They're the ones who are usually talking loudest. You know, I don't think anyone should feel bad, certainly should not feel bad about what they don't know. I was saying this last night. Whether it's at a restaurant, at a wine shop, wherever, this is a business transaction. And these are people who ultimately are there to sell you something. And so I think all you have to do is come with, not with what you think are the right wine terms, not with what you think is going to impress the guy behind the counter. It's like walking into indie bookshop, but like an indie record store, and feeling like you have to be able to talk, you know, chapter and verse on vinyl. I think it's easiest to go in, have a sense of what you like, have a sense of what you've liked to drink in the past, and where you want to enjoy the wine, maybe what you're going to have with it, and be able to explain kind of the things that you like and you don't, and that's it. And frankly, if that doesn't work, then you know, then sort of back out and go shop somewhere else, because it's not okay for people to feel inadequate in terms of being a customer.
So let's talk about some just basics. What is the difference between a sweet and a dry wine?
Well, a dry wine will have no what's called residual sugar, so sugar that's left over from the fermentation process in it. A sweet wine will have some left for one reason or other. It's not a binary system, if you will. There's a grid in the book that shows you that it's dry and sweet exist on this spectrum, as does the other half of that equation, which is fruity and savory, because a lot of people think that that fruity is sweet, but fruity is fruity. And sweetness is literally about the sugar.
Yeah, I loved that matrix because I immediately went to the sweet and savory.
Right.
Because so many of us love that in food, right?
Exactly. Although it's funny, those are the wines that are almost impossible to sell.
So if we want to start enjoying, do we need to start collecting or can we just buy bottles and drink them? What is the benefit to going that step and deciding to, quote, collect?
I don't think that anyone needs to collect wine in In L.A., it's probably a little bit more permissible, only in that there's maybe a bit more space in everyone's house or apartment versus New York, where I live now. But there's also a temperature that may not be the friendliest to wine. Collecting wine is honestly kind of this holdover from old European traditions when wines weren't really that good to drink upon release. And they were hard, they were unpleasant, they were very tannic for red wines. But back to baseball stats, everyone loves collecting stuff. And there is something that is pleasurable about seeing a wine evolve in the course of a number of years. And there are wines that do get more interesting. But I also think that collecting has become a bit of blood sport, and or did become a bit of blood sport. And it was all about, you know, who had the oldest, who had the biggest, who had the fanciest. And one of the rules in the book is that if you really do want to start collecting wine, just to satisfy your curiosity, it's not, you know, you can basically do it for under $300, and you can buy wines that are not the fancy collectible wines, but that certainly will get more interesting with time.
So this idea of wine now, the way it's made, being more mature when it's released, and by mature, I don't even really mean age, just more
approachable, yeah.
Yeah, more approachable. This idea of buying wine and opening it immediately, that's okay.
Totally okay. And again, like that sort of snobby wine community was, I mean, the stat is, I think, something like 80% of wines that are bought are consumed within 24 hours. But people would say, you know, most of it is consumed before you leave the parking lot. And it was meant as kind of a derisive joke. But the thing is, like, who cares? That's the whole point. In fact, shouldn't the wine industry want us to be buying wine and drinking it and buying some more? And legitimately, some of it, for a long time, wines were made, even when made competently, were still sort of hard to drink when they were young. Remember that most of the wine-growing regions in the world until recently were really struggling to get wines adequately ripe. And so one of the reasons you would age it is because often grapes weren't quite picked ripe and you needed the unripe flavors to mellow out. And so a lot of that has now been taken away because there's better farming, there's more competent winemaking, and the style of wine has just become more pleasurable when young. I am happy to age things. We have an unreasonably large wine fridge at home that is aging some stuff. But I think one of the rules is drink your wine young, and I think there's great value to not feeling like you just have to wait for exactly that moment to open a bottle.
One of the things that you hear so much about these days is, quote, natural wine. A lot of us have no idea what it even means or if we'll even like it.
Me included.
Could you just go through a few of winemaking styles? You have this great kind of chart that talks about the different processes, the stages of the winemaking before fermentation, and then aging, finishing, pre-bottling, and what is involved given all of these different, quote, styles.
Sure. Natural wine is a really interesting development in wine in that it is prompting good discussions about how you farm and how you work in the cellar. It is also a bit fraught in that no one can really come up with a good definition. And even the people who love it, you see them try to talk about the generally agreed upon things, but even they can't quite agree on them. So it is still this discussion. And In this book, I didn't want to weigh in one way or the other. I think there's really interesting natural wines, but I didn't want to impose my views either way because this is for people who are just discovering. So let's look at a few of the terms that I had to classify one way or the other. So
I also, one of the things that I found fascinating about this particular page of the book is the industrial stuff too, because it talks about things I've never heard of.
Yeah.
Like Spinning Cone. And Mega Purple.
Yeah. Spinning Cone is a very elaborate and very expensive process, mostly for removing alcohol from wine. And so the wine is sort of split into its component parts and a certain amount of ethanol is removed and then sort of put back together.
So it's kind of, it reminds me of what happens to milk these days. So
Yeah. We
never get milk from the, you know, like it is straight from the cow. It's all split up into every single part and then it's reconstituted depending on what kind they're selling.
Yeah. And this is even more so because it's literally extracting the alcohol. And so what that does is you can pick very, very ripe grapes. You can come out with a wine that's, let's say, 16% alcohol. And then you can just kind of tweak it down to 13%. And one, you pay less tax on it, which is really only an issue for very large wineries. But two, you change the profile of the wine and it's not suddenly this boozy port-like thing anymore, even though it has ripe flavors. And then Mega Purple, really quickly. It's always fun to talk about Mega Purple. It is a intensely dark and actually very sweet grape juice concentrate made mostly from a hybrid grape called Ruby Red that predominantly in the San Joaquin Valley. And it's usually sold in either or gallons or buckets or whatever. And you use it in relatively small amounts, again, in industrial wineries, to primarily to darken the color of red wine. So if you have what people think is too light a wine, it's Mega Purple. It makes it dark. It also, because it is, again, really sweet. It does add, not doesn't turn a wine sweet, but it does add just a little bit of phantom sweetness to it, and it rounds out the flavors. And so it's this kind of slightly dodgy technique to darken and polish a wine. And of course, because it's made from grape juice, it's still technically wine.
That's John Bonnet. He's the author of the incredibly helpful handbook, The New Wine Rules. Coming up, Israeli cuisine is currently having a very big moment. So we're talking with Israeli-born chef Alon Shaya. Stick around. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. Alon Shaya describes Israeli cuisine as a gumbo, a melding of many food cultures. Sure, his first cookbook is full of recipes and tastes that we've learned to crave from his New Orleans restaurant, but it's also a journey through his life. As a boy in Israel, to an immigrant in Pennsylvania, a chef in Italy, to a phenom in Louisiana. And what has been his constant? The food. You say that you can trace all your food memories back to one moment. What was it?
I was in first grade, living in Philadelphia, not long after my family immigrated from Israel. And I was coming home from school one day, and I opened the front door to my house and was hit with this aroma of peppers and eggplants roasting over an open flame in the kitchen. And that aroma of charred, blistering pepper and eggplant skin really made me think of two things. One was that my grandmother was visiting from Israel because I could smell her cooking. And two was that my life would be normal again for as long as she was going to be there.
Share with us a bit about what abnormal was or what non-normal was when she wasn't there.
So, you know, we had immigrated to America when I was 4 years old, but my father had come 2 years before that to begin raising money and you know, setting up an apartment, a car, and all these things for when my sister and my mother and I came out. So it took a couple years, and when we arrived to America, you know, life automatically for me as a four-year-old was completely turned upside down. We're in a different country. I didn't speak English. You know, I had left all my friends, and my sister was going through the same feelings as well. And so was my mom. So we were all kind of in this state of shock. About a year later, my mother left my father and began raising us on her own in a house that her sister had bought for us. And, you know, I now was a few years older and around 7, 8 years old. And, you know, I was having a really tough time. I was working on trying to assimilate into America and push everything that I knew about Israel behind. And when that aroma of peppers and eggplants hit me, it was like I was transported back to Israel.
During this period when you were a kid and you were having a hard time, your mom was working a couple different jobs to keep the family afloat, and you spent a fair amount of time unsupervised or on your own. Did you use food as a way to entertain yourself?
I absolutely did. I, from a young age, would spend time with my grandmother in the kitchen and my mother in the kitchen because again, I felt like I was kind of home again when I was cooking the foods that I remembered eating in Israel. And I also had a lot of time on my hands. When my mom was working two jobs, I would come home from school, figured out lots of ways to get into trouble and cause a lot of stress on my mom. And I also spent a lot of time in the kitchen cooking because it felt like a release of energy for me.
Then you meet Donna Barnett. Tell us who she is and how she contributed to changing your life.
Yeah, so, you know, several years had gone by, and at this point I was in high school, and my mischievous behavior, you know, turned into misdemeanors and felony charges. I was getting into a lot of trouble. I was hanging out with the wrong people, getting arrested for it. You know, I was dealing drugs and getting kicked out of class and skipping school. You know, I was just a really angry kid. I took a home economics class, and it was Donna's class, so that I could be close to girls and knives. You know, I was in her class, and Donna was the first real instructor for me that took me seriously and that, like, gave me an opportunity to communicate with her. And she became this mentor to me through high school. She stepped in and eventually got me a job at a restaurant and made sure that, you know, I showed up to the interview on time and that I was dressed the right way. And she helped me navigate my way to applying for scholarships and grants to get into culinary school and helped me through that whole process. She was like a real guardian angel for me. She became like a mother to me.
So you go through this whole period of time where you end up in New Orleans by way of Las Vegas and St. Louis. And after Katrina, you go to work in Italy for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come back to New Orleans and you open Domenica's, which is an Italian place. Yet you start to think about Israeli food. You start to think about your heritage.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm like in my 30s at this point, and I have decided that I would be an Italian chef. You know, I moved to Italy and apprenticed out there, and I began speaking Italian, and I bought a Vespa, and I had a man purse, and my wife would call me Alonzo. And in 2011, I had already had Domenica open for a couple of years, and it was receiving, you know, a lot of really great recognition, and people in the community really, really liked it. It was a busy restaurant, and my confidence as a chef was really growing. And I took a trip to Israel, and I found myself, you know, walking through the markets in Israel, smelling those peppers and eggplants cooking over open flame and hearing little Jewish ladies speaking Hebrew and smelling the spices and eating the stuffed grape leaves and the burekas and the halva and all of these things that reminded me of home again, right? And reminded me of normalcy. It made me, of course, miss my grandparents, but it also kind of helped me understand that I was missing so much of who I was. I was still, you know, 30 years later, pushing Israel away, right, to become more American or then even Italian. I came back to New Orleans to work at Domenica, and I started working on a recipe for whole roasted cauliflower, which I had at a restaurant called Abraxas in Tel Aviv, and was just blown away by this dish. And I vowed to come back to America and figure out a recipe that I could create that would make it Italian-ish and that I, you know, could execute at Domenica. And so I began testing all these recipes, and we ended up with this recipe for whole roasted cauliflower with whipped feta cheese. And that, to me, in my head, was 100% Israeli food, but I was passing it off as this, like, you know, incredible Italian dish. And everyone went crazy for this roasted cauliflower, and it got written up in all these national magazines and was, you know, everyone kind of knew me as, like, the cauliflower guy in the Central Business District of New Orleans.
You were serving, and, like, 700 heads a week?
Oh, yeah. We were going through a lot of cauliflower. The cauliflower gave me the confidence to keep going. And so next thing you know, I'm making shakshuka in the pizza oven with chanterelle mushrooms and goat shoulder and, you know, calling it Italian baked eggs. And I'm putting za'atar spice on pizza crust and doing all of these things that, like, all my friends that would come in to eat would be like, oh, great new Italian dish, Alon. And I'm like, yeah, it's really not. It's really Israeli food. And eventually it got so bad that I needed to have an outlet for it. And that's when I opened Shaya.
So much of our identity is wrapped up in our name. And without going into too much detail, you're no longer partners with John Besh and his restaurant group. Yet the James Beard Award-winning restaurant you put on the map still bears your name. Can you talk a bit about name and identity and what's next on the horizon for you?
Yeah, of course. I could not be any more excited about the direction that our team is now heading with the opening of Saba in New Orleans and Safta, which opens in Denver this summer.
And those are the names that you called your grandmother and your grandfather.
Yeah, those are the grandparents of our company, of Pomegranate Hospitalities, Saba and Safta. You know, I am no longer at Shaya Restaurant. I was not able to win the rights to my name in court. And so I, you know, had to move on. But what has happened has been such a blessing in the sense that I really understand my path forward now on a much bigger level than just food. When I left Shaya, I had started Pomegranate Hospitality. You know, the first thing I did was write a mission statement for what Pomegranate Hospitality was going to be about. And it is all about putting the team members that make up our company first and creating an environment that is welcoming and warm and safe and comfortable and empowering, a company that holds itself accountable and a company that really promotes respect and trust. And that is what we've been spending the last 8 months on doing and building the foundation for. So with the opening of Saba and Safta coming up, you know, now is our chance to live up to the promises that we're making and to do what we say we're going to do.
Well, thank you so much and much luck to you.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Israel-born chef Alon Shaya. His first cookbook is simply called Shaya. That's it for our show this week. If you missed any part of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. And if you like the show, please leave us a review. It helps other people find it. Many thanks to the Good Food team. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.